And we've shown this architecture to some of the smartest people in the DeFi community, some of the smartest people in the institutional community. And everybody's like, yep, that's it. That's what it is. That's how it's going to work.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join us as we delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver market insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit subscribe for your bi-weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto's a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid anytime, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently.
Welcome to the FCAT Crypto Brief. This episode today, I'm joined by Parth Gargava, and today we'll be talking with Sergey Nazarov from Chainlink. So if you're not familiar, we're going to dive into what Chainlink is, how it's evolved. But before we do that, Parth, I just wanted to ask you a question, sort of setting the stage based on the date we're recording. Did you see last night that the Senate passed the Genius Act?
I think that's pretty massive. And I'm actually really curious to see how Sergey thinks about it.
Yeah, and I know, Sergey, you've had a lot of interactions with folks in the legislative and regulatory environments. But this passed 68-30, which I think is really telling. And although it's headed over to the House for some reconciliation or comparison to what the House version is called stable, it signals progress, which I think is much appreciated by many of us in the industry. But Sergey, what's your take on that?
I think it's a really big deal that's going to kick off on a new wave of stable coins from banks, fintechs, even technology companies, because stable coins are now going to be safe from a compliance and risk point of view for institutions to make. I think stable coins, as they stand now, are very aligned with global dollar reserve currency status for the U.S. dollar. And so I think the U.S. government, you know, finally kind of woke up with the new administration and shifted away from trying to suppress stable coins to seeing it as a distribution mechanism for the U.S. dollar in this new and growing Web3 kind of crypto economy. And so with the stablecoin legislation that's passed now will do is it mandates the creation of guidance. It creates some guidance of its own, but it basically signals a different level of risk to making a stablecoin that is below the risk threshold of banks and financial institutions. Before, making a stablecoin was above the approved risk threshold, and so it didn't happen. And this is why you're going to see you know, hundreds of stable coins, thousands of stable coins globally. And what every country, I think, will want to encourage is the creation of a stable coin, A, in their financial system, and B, backed by their fiat currency, which is what the U.S. dollar now needs to get ahead of by continuing to be the dominant form of fiat payment in the Web3 world. Amazingly, the U.S., despite the U.S. government's extremely negative stance on stablecoins for so many years, the vast majority, over 90% of all fiat value in stablecoins, is still U.S. dollar backed, which is a kind of benefit of the U.S. dollar's dominance in other sectors that isn't Web3. But as the Web3 sector grows, I think the U.S., and now the U.S. understands this, the U.S. government in the legislative branch and the executive branch both understand now and very clearly see and very clearly want stable coins globally to remain at 90% or more US dollar backed stable coins in terms of transaction volume, in terms of actual usage. So it's very positive for stable coins, very positive for our industry. The final thing I'll say is that it creates the buy side market for digital assets. So if you have, you know, if you go from tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands to millions to eventually billions of stablecoin holders, that also represents a market that can now very easily transact against a digital asset like a tokenized fund. And so the more stablecoin holders you have, the more of a market the tokenized fund and the digital asset issuance folks have. to provide digital assets and tokenized funds into, which is extremely positive, right? Because the dynamic we're really going for in this industry is a lot of people with stable coins, a lot of people with all kinds of payment-related mechanisms on chain, and a lot of high-quality digital assets on chain, and then, you know, just volume, lots of volume, and lots of successful, lucrative transactions for people against those digital assets, which means more digital assets. That's really, so I think the stablecoin thing is a big, big catalyst. If it results in the large amount of purchasing power going on chain in the form of stablecoins, then I think it will, then, you know, historically, it could be viewed as a, as like one of these watershed moments, these historical key tipping point moments. But that's only if it results in going from about 200 billion in stablecoin purchasing power to 500 billion, a trillion, 2 trillion.
Yeah, it's, you know, just to build off that, because I personally agree with a lot of what you're saying there, and just contextualizing, you have a U.S. deficit that is in the mid 30 trillions. And as we think about the issuance of debt to fund the government, having additional buyers of that debt who can, you know, help maintain the demand, I think is really interesting, because they've sort of stepped in where in the past we had more foreign buyers, and now they've sort of stepped back, and stablecoin issuers or tokenized vehicles, whether they be tokenized treasuries or funds that represent these assets in token form, have stepped in, which I think is really interesting.
Jason and Sergey, what I want to do is I kind of want to take maybe 100 steps back, because we have a few folks in the audience, and I actually happen to know them, who are, you know, the batch of 2025, when they heard about stable coins for the first time, they saw Bitcoin hitting 100,000 for the first time. So Sergey, a lot of people know and have heard of Chainlink, but do you mind explaining what Chainlink is and how it's evolved in the last 8 years now?
Sure. So Chainlink is basically a collection of protocols and standards that solve the connectivity, data, identity, and certain other key computational problems that blockchains need solved but can't solve themselves. I'll give you some examples to make it clear. Stablecoins, for example, require, and will, I think, by law, eventually require something called proof of reserves. And so Chainlink is the largest provider of proof of reserves to the most stable coins, commodity coins, and other coins that require proof of reserves. And what Chainlink does is it verifies that the assets backing the stablecoin or backing the digital asset exist. And so for stablecoins, that's called proof of reserves. For tokenized funds, it's called net asset value. So we transmit the net asset value of the fund on chain. In other cases, Chainlink transmits market data. In other cases, Chainlink connects chains. In other cases, Chainlink proves identity on chain. And in other cases, it actually connects you and runs AI models for you that do risk management and other things. So Chainlink is, at this point, almost like the AWS of decentralized infrastructure, in the sense that it gives you so many different things. It gives you data oracles. It gives you connectivity oracles. It gives you identity oracles. It gives you AI oracles. And the reason I keep saying oracles is because oracles and oracle networks are the technology that Chainlink pioneered. This technology, what it does is it verifies things about the world in a way that they can be relied upon to transfer and control value. So before, if you were trying to build a tokenized fund or a decentralized finance application like a lending market, you would basically have a smart contract on a chain that was very reliable and that everyone agreed would only function within a certain narrow set of parameters that no one else could modify. But you didn't have, before Chainlink, a way to guarantee that the inputs into that smart contract would work a certain way, because those inputs were still modifiable and controlled by a lot of systems that did not meet that same reliability or censorship resistance or tamper-proof standard of smart contracts, right? Because the value of smart contracts is not that they automate things. It's that they automate things in a hyper-reliable, deterministically guaranteed way that can't be modified and that everyone can rely on working as expected. And so many agreements, many contracts have to be resolved. to be resolved, they need market prices. They need information about assets. They need connectivity now to other chains where there's other assets that they're traded against. For example, Chainlink now connects many institutions to enable them to send a stablecoin in exchange for a tokenized fund. And they remove the stablecoin. The network moves the stablecoin from one chain to another. And then the tokenized fund, tokenized asset fund version goes to the chain over the same rails. But really what Chainlink has become now is this platform that has all of these capabilities in a single system. And that's particularly important because the nature of institutional transactions is that they're extremely complex. They have a large amount of accounting requirements, AML, KYC identity requirements, data requirements that can only be sourced from certain specific places in very specific ways. And that's also required by law. And they also have various custody and control location and asset movement requirements. And right now, what Chainlink has really become is a single system in which you can move assets across chains in a way that is comprehensive, where you're able to solve the data problem, you're able to solve the cross-chain connectivity problem, you're able to solve the identity and AML KYC problem, and you're able to solve a number of other additional problems like risk management through AI oracles and so on. One really great recent example of this is actually our work with HKMA, ANZ Bank, and Fidelity International, where basically there was a tokenized fund from Fidelity International where Chainlink provided the NAV data into the tokenized fund. Then there was a sending of a stablecoin from the ANZ side. Then there was a sending of, there's going to be now a sending of a tokenized fund back in exchange for that stablecoin.
Yeah, and just to be clear, this was a proof of concept.
And in addition to the sending of the stablecoin, the sending of the tokenized fund, the provision of data on chain to make it all work, there was also now a compliance engine from Chainlink that proved various identity things about both parties to each other, also cross-chain, using something called CCID, the cross-chain ID. And all of this was solved in a single system. So now what Chainlink has really become is a set of transactional standards for defining how blockchain transactions work inside of chains and between chains, and even outside of chains when the blockchain transactions want to reach out and do something outside. And that's particularly important for the institutional world because the institutional world has a lot more hard requirements, gating requirements, that if you don't solve identity and AML KYC compliance, if you don't solve synchronization with the accounting system, if you don't solve sourcing data from a very specific place that's approved by regulators for the valuation of a specific asset before it is even moved or transacted against, then you're just not going to have a blockchain transaction. So that is the very big difference now of the Chainlink now versus the Chainlink 4 or 5 years ago, where Chainlink was then powering the majority of DeFi. Chainlink still powers the majority of DeFi, approximately 70%, depending on the day and sometimes more, and in certain verticals like lending and others, more. But now we are in a world where Chainlink needs to power this institutional growth and it needs to power the DeFi growth. And where I think we're going to end up is that this set of transactional standards is going to get the DeFi world and the TradFi world interacting with each other. That's actually the stage of the industry and the stage of Chainlink's development and what it's going to be doing now that I think we're at now.
Sergey, I want to dig deeper into the point that you made around transactions between institutions and if they are across different chains. What do you think is the biggest reason between private, public chains or different kinds of chains that makes them really hard to connect? And how do you fix that? I'd love for you to go into more specifics.
That is a serious security and reliability issue. And so the Chainlink community has gravitated towards solving these security and reliability issues about data and connection points around chains that have been unsolved and that are very useful and important. And in the original Chainlink white paper back from 2017, it mentions cross-chain, it mentions data, it mentions all these things. There's just a certain order in which this is happening. I think what the Chainlink community and I and others saw is that the bridging providers that existed before Chainlink were simply insecure. And many of them are still simply insecure. There are bridging providers out there that have a single node controlling the bridge. There are bridging providers out there that have been hacked multiple times, and year after year, they keep getting critical vulnerability hacks discovered. There are bridging providers out there that use their signing keys to day trade. So there's bridging providers that have signing keys where they're signing against the multi-sig of a bridge or all of their bridges. And those same signing keys are not cold wallets. They're hot wallets where people are buying things like Pepe Coin, and they're using them for day trading instead of securing the multi-sig of their bridge. So there are a lot of wacky things going on. There are a lot of insane things going on out in the world, and they're still happening, by the way. And this is where Chainlink kind of excels, surpassing the problem statement, right? So Chainlink's goal is not to just meet the problem statement of some minimal security, it's to surpass that. And then to clarify for people what, you know, the security guarantees are in different versions of Oracle networks and connections. So the problem with cross-chain is that you want to create enough security and decentralization and key security, private key security, such that the generation of tokens moving across chains is immune to manipulation and theft, okay? That's what you want to do. And this results in solving what we call the secondary minting problem. So when you make a token, you have two basic problems. The first one is the primary minting risk. The primary minting risk is, for example, that you could infinite mint and you could mint more tokens than are supposed to be minted on the native initial chain where the tokens are initially created. This is actually what proof of reserve solves. And proof of reserves has a feature called secure mint. And secure mint is actually smart contract code that goes into the minting contract for the initial token generation, for the initial token minting. And unless the Oracle network from the Chainlink ecosystem verifies that you have the corresponding dollar to mint an additional corresponding stablecoin token, the minting can't happen because the smart contract won't let it happen. And so that's how you control primary minting risk. But then you have secondary minting risk. And secondary minting risk is the movement of a token between chains, but really it's the locking and minting or the burning and minting of a token on another chain in another place. So now you're minting again. You minted initially over here in the chain where you initially generated the token. You want to guarantee that that's reliable. And so that's where the proof of reserve secure mint comes in. And then you want to move the token to another chain, like the example that I gave you where the stable coin from ANZ was sent over in exchange for the tokenized fund. There, you basically find the need to move cross-chain to do delivery versus payment, to exchange the stable coin for the asset. And this is where secondary minting risk takes hold, and this is where you need a bridging system, and you want that bridging system to have very strong guarantees that are not about having a single node or two nodes, that are not about people mismanaging the private keys of these bridges, and that are not about systems that get hacked for, you know, 300 million and then have security vulnerabilities found year after year, year after year. Like every year, there's another security vulnerability in this bridge. And that's unfortunately the state of bridging still out there, but there is a migration now onto CCIP, onto the Chainlink standard for bridging because of the security guarantees in CCIP, where CCIP actually uses multiple Oracle networks. And those multiple Oracle networks verify multiple separate things that are required to prove that a transaction is true and accurate. Those multiple separate Oracle networks have separate collections of high quality nodes. And those Oracle networks are generating a very high level of security, the same level of security that's allowed Chainlink to enable over $21 trillion worth of transaction value so far. So we already saw this actually in the data space, where when Chainlink started, there were a few centralized oracles here, a few centralized things there. A lot of stuff was getting hacked, a lot of data oracle issues. And Chainlink pretty much became the global standard at 70% or more, and even more than that in lending, because of those security guarantees. So that's the thesis of Chainlink. The thesis of Chainlink is that if you're going to make hyper reliable blockchain-based financial applications, then you need hyper-reliable services for data, cross-chain connectivity, legacy system integration, and all kinds of other things like identity and compliance. Because an adversary can get into the contract or they can get into this other system, and both of those systems need to meet a high standard. My view is the systems that don't meet this standard and the people and the tokens that use those systems, in my experience, like with multi-chain and these other past things that got hacked or basically stopped operating, the tokens on those systems get massively devalued because the secondary minted version of them now has this massive associated tech risk. And this massive tech risk creates a huge kind of risk devaluation of the token, even if the token itself is okay, even if the company that made the token. So my view is that cross-chain bridging and initial minting are both very important dimensions of technical risk that the people generating those tokens and the people deciding how to move those tokens across chains need to take seriously. Because if some other token somewhere on that same bridging infrastructure is improperly secured, then that will impact how people view all the tokens on that bridging infrastructure.
So Sergey, it's so interesting to see the evolution of interop from bridging to protocols like CCIP. And it seems like Chainlink now also has cross-chain services into the Solana ecosystem. Now, if anyone has tried spinning up a node on ETH and Solana, you know that they're two extremely disparate systems. The data structure is different. The storage is different. And obviously, it's a different virtual machine in itself. What was your experience, or what was the team's experience adding Solana to your cross-chain capabilities? And how does this integration help solve a basic need for DeFi at this point?
The Solana integration took a little time. Chainlink sometimes takes a little bit longer to do some integrations or to do some things because the security reviews, the security audits is something we take very seriously. If you cut corners on those things, sometimes you can integrate a little bit faster into something. So Chainlink took time to really do the security audits, evaluate all the different nuances between EVM and Solana and now other non-EVMs. Now it's successfully integrated. We're already seeing users migrate onto CCIP for usage on Solana due to security guarantees. I think Solana's goal is what they call internet capital markets. And internet capital markets in the Solana ecosystem basically means institutions. And if you look at the institutions that are using cross-chain systems, you'll basically see that they pretty much exclusively or almost exclusively are looking to use Chainlink across the amounts of POCs, pilots, all the other things that we're doing that are going to production, so on and so on. I think what you're really going to arrive at is a world where the security guarantees, the compliance capabilities, the kind of risk management capabilities of CCIP and its ability to meet the high standards of these institutions will mean that all the institutional flows are basically on CCIP. And those institutional flows are going to be what's important for Solana, for other chains. And that's really what CCIP is right now excelling at and built for. It's built for excelling at executing those complex compliance dependent transactions across chains, which takes into account all kinds of key factors around the security of the system, control location, signing requirements, all these different factors that many other bridges, they don't even know what these factors are because we know because when people go talk to them and ask them about them, they're like, that's a great question. Whereas Chainlink provides a comprehensive answer and a comprehensive plan and set of features. So that's what I think Solana is going to care about. Lots of other non-EVMs and L2s and L1s, whether they're EVM or non-EVM, are going to care about. But yeah, I can see the Solana ecosystem growing. I can see a lot of great non-EVM systems growing. And really, just so you know, like where we're trying to get to is that chain choice actually shouldn't matter, in my opinion. So I think Solana has a lot of interesting scalability and great characteristics. The Ethereum community is trying to do some exciting stuff to increase their scalability. There's a lot of great stuff happening. But when you and me get on the internet, the normal internet, you and me don't need to figure out if I'm on AWS and you're on Google Cloud, and Jason is on Azure, right? And how do we do it to transact or send each other information if Jason built his systems on Azure and you know, Parth built his systems on Google Cloud and Sergey built his systems on AWS? How does it all work? Like, how do we connect? Like, man, what a problem. That's not a problem, right? It's a non-issue. And it's a non-issue because you have TCP/IP, you have a single globally accepted standard that can properly connect all of these systems. And so wherever you want to spin up a blockchain, like you can spin up a private chain, and you should just be able to access all the private keys, all the data, all the assets on all the other chains. And it should be a seamless, low-cost, highly efficient process for you, such that if you make a private chain because you want to control fees, you want to control that infrastructure, you want to do whatever with it, you know, you can put your digital assets on there and then you can cross-chain it back out into wherever somebody wants to send you a stable coin from, which will be thousands upon thousands of chains. And the interoperability question should become a non-question, a non-issue. Just like it's a non-issue when you spin up a cloud server in one cloud and I spin up a cloud server in another cloud, it's a non-issue how our two cloud instances are going to communicate about whatever, value transfer, data transfer. That's really what CCIP does, is it creates that TCP/IP-like relationship across all the chains and all the contracts.
I think it's a great analogy to use. And frankly, Sergey, I think the first time I met and spoke with you was a few years back, prior to the platform approach, and we were having some conversations about standards. So I really appreciate that you're continuing to hit on the standards. And at the time, we were talking about things like ISO formatted messaging and how TradFi uses networks like the Swift network to communicate. But I just want to call out for our users, not only have you done work with the Swift network and some other partners to bridge TradFi and DeFi, but just the simple mechanics where in some cases they're batch processed, very slow. You talk about Ethereum, you know, you're talking seconds for a block to be added, and you're talking about Solana where it's milliseconds for a block to be added. And I think what that does is it subtly frames that the technology can meet the need regardless of the mechanism of the technology that you're interacting with. And I think that challenge of making sure that you have atomic or simultaneous recognition of transactions when you are working in more than one location, whether it be two chains or an off-chain and on a chain. You know, I think it's really impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're going to need all of this integration, interoperability across chains, data, compliance, if you want to see institutions go on chain. And I do think that the institutional world and the DeFi world are basically each other's best customers. And I think that's where the net new capital is going to flow into our industry from, and therefore flow into the DeFi system. And I also think that there's going to be a significant amount of interest from the public chain community as it grows beyond, you know, 3.5, 4, 5, whatever trillion to interact with the financial products generated from the institutional world. So I think really these two groups seem like they're different, but they're not different. They're basically doing the same thing with different words and with different approaches and with different levels of compliance and with different levels of sensitivity to various risks. But they're actually basically, if you abstract away people's names and you abstract away, you know, a lot of kind of subjective views on this ideological point or that ideological point, they're just doing financial transactions. And they can provide a lot of value to each other because the DeFi people can create more quickly create certain financial products that simply cannot be created in the traditional world, or at least can't be created very quickly. So they're going to, I think, have a consistent lead doing what's called permissionless innovation, mm-hmm. where they're able to generate yield and various tokenization of things that were unheard of before. And then the traditional finance institutions, I think, will continue to provide a hyper-reliable, highly regulated environment for custody, for issuance, for a whole bunch of things that regulated financial institutions do well, which is manage risk, have all kinds of risk controls, have all kinds of security requirements, And it is against both the permissionless innovation speed as well as the risk and security requirements of the institutions that Chainlink is built. It's built against those two groups because really that global set of standards is going to be necessary for them to transact. And so that's, I think, what the Chainlink community's goal is to generate that global set of standards.
Sergey, I want to quickly touch on your point around permissionless innovation. One of the points that I really enjoyed about the Chainlink community is the fact that it used to be a developer-focused community, and I believe it still is. My question is, what are some core limitations as of now for someone building an on-chain application? And I'd love to know more about CRE, which is Chainlink Runtime Environment, and how does that help developers innovate?
Sure, absolutely. Chainlink has a great developer community. I think for a number of reasons, part of the reason is that there's so many developer users of Chainlink services across all these different categories of data compliance, identity, cross-chain, and so on. So that makes its own big community. I think we have many great hackathons, which I'm a big fan of and which I know people do a lot of great stuff at. We've had hackathon winners from some of the largest custodian banks, some of the largest asset managers. So the TradFi community is pretty actively involved in our hackathons as well. So it's a mix of DeFi and TradFi developers working together on exciting things. And yeah, generally Chainlink is made to be a very developer-friendly set of protocols and infrastructures that can provide all of this value to developers quickly and efficiently, which developers like. I think the problems that developers face are really like three sets of problems. One set of problems would be the limitations of the chains. So what are the limitations of the chains? Whether that's a scalability limitation, whether that's a cost limitation, whether that's a privacy limitation, whether that's a deployment and management of nodes limitation, whether that's an RPC uptime limitation. There's all these nuances around chains that are not solved problems. Scalability is not a solved problem. Cost is not a solved problem. Privacy is not a solved problem. Reliability of connecting to chains, reorgs are still, you know, something that create issues with the concept of finality because you could still have reorgs on chains. So there's a lot of unsolved problems there. Then you have the world that Oracle Networks existed and the Chainlink exists in, which is all the stuff that blockchains and smart contracts need to operate, but that blockchains and smart contracts don't do themselves. This is data, identity, connectivity between chains, connectivity with traditional systems, connectivity with AI systems, so on and so on. I think a portion of those blockchain problems can be solved by Oracle Networks, but not all of them. So those fundamental blockchain scalability, cost, privacy, speed, and other problems still need to be solved in ways that can scale to like global NASDAQ levels, right? That's Visa speeds, Visa levels. And if you're saying it's all on one chain, then it's actually Visa and NASDAQ and New York Stock Exchange and MasterCard all on one chain. So that's like what we're saying if we're saying one chain. If we're saying many chains, we're saying something else, right? We're saying subdivision of the load on multiple different chains. The Oracle Networks solve the problems of data, connectivity, cross-chain, identity compliance. That's where Chainlink has historically been known to rapidly accelerate what the industry can do. So Chainlink is beloved by the DeFi community. It's beloved by many other sub-communities within the blockchain industry because Chainlink is the system that provides them the secure and reliable inputs and outputs and additional services that are needed to make the contracts possible. For example, DeFi was a sub-$100 million industry with about 10 to 15 teams when Chainlink was starting. And then it grew to over $200 billion with thousands and thousands of teams, with Chainlink now over time consistently powering the majority of DeFi. And so that's the first thing that Chainlink did is it generated these data connections, now identity connections, cross-chain connections, and so on. The next stage of this is institutional adoption, as we've said. And in the institutional world, what developers rely on very heavily are frameworks and basically systems that create abstraction and simplify the development of complex financial applications. COBOL is a good example from the 70s. Java and the Java runtime environment is a good example from the 90s when everything was starting to get on the internet. And the Chainlink environment basically follows this pattern, where it allows developers to write a single piece of code, and in that single piece of code, manage their financial application's relationship with hundreds of chains, the data that needs to go on chain, the identity and compliance contracts that need to approve or deny and manage the relationship with all of the identity and compliance legal requirements, as well as a number of other off-chain systems for accounting, risk management, AI, and so on. We in the Chainlink community have had many years of experience composing all of these pieces together, getting some institutional transactional flow to work across two or three chains with multiple pieces of data, meeting identity and compliance requirements, and even doing that together with central banks. So the example I told you with ANZ and Fidelity International was with HKMA using EHKD. With the MAS last year, there were three big transactions we announced, one with SBI UBS, one with UBS and Swift, and another one with ANZ. And so we know in the Chainlink community how to build all of this stuff in separate pieces. But the pieces have become so many and so complicated that you actually now need a different piece that will manage all that complexity. So you need a single place to write code that defines the financial application's relationship and manages that relationship and makes sure that that relationship is meeting all the requirements of that financial institution against hundreds of chains, many different data sources, usually for cross-border, at least two or maybe even three regulatory regimes and compliance sets of compliance policies and requirements. More and more AI for risk management and various other decision-making in the financial markets and many other external systems. That is what the CRE does. The CRE lets you write what's called workflow code. Workflow code is meant to be pretty simple and direct in that you can write it in existing languages. Now you can write it in Go, soon Rust. We're looking at Java and other languages, and we've gotten a lot of requests for some of them. So the community will prioritize those languages based on the need in the various institutions moving the fastest to get on chain. But now, as a developer in an institution, you can sit down and in a language that you know, you can write one piece of code where you define how it all works. The alternative is that you write 15 or 20 pieces of code that 5 to 10 separate engineers know and that nobody knows all at once. And you rely on one piece of code in that system and that piece of code in this system. Good parallels to this are things like what GitHub Actions does. Another good parallels are what Terraform did for DevOps, where they made a single system to manage the complexity of multiple clouds. So this is a common pattern that I think will be a necessity for the institutional adoption of blockchains at scale. And so Chainlink, as it sometimes is a community and as a set of standards, is ahead of the curve very much in this respect, where we are already giving this to institutions and we are already powering certain transactional flows. For example, our work with JP Morgan was run on the CRE, and our work with others has been run on the CRE. Our work announced with Swift at the end of last year was also built on CRE. And I have to tell you, from seeing how quickly we're able to build this workflow code with a partner, what usually would have taken months now takes weeks. And we're in the process of getting it down to days and eventually hours. And when you can get it down to that level of efficiency while providing the security and reliability that institutions want, that's what I think leads to mainstream institutional adoption of blockchain technology. When you give them a place where they can manage the complexity of hundreds of chains, tens of data sources, multiple compliance policies, and now it's not a multi-year or multi-month, you know, what people call journey to launch a category of assets. It's what it is in the web world, which is a couple of developers following standardized, highly secure and reliable practices, which if you told the counterparty how you built it, if you told the counterparty, I built the workflow for this in CRE, here's my workflow code. Are you comfortable with the technical risk of this workflow code managing our transaction? Now the counterparty can evaluate that and say, yes, you know, this looks very standard. We ran it through an AI to tell if you did anything, you know, abnormal. Let's just do the transaction. And that's when you get to mainstream institutional adoption. And Chainlink is now, I think, well-positioned to be in the epicenter of that, both in the terms of providing the key services, the data services, the compliance services, the connectivity services, the legacy system integration services, but also now providing the abstraction layer and the environment in which you manage and define the relationship between those services, those chains, and your institution.
It's a really interesting vision of the future that you paint here. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that this transition for institutions from the legacy architecture and infrastructure and use of entities like central securities depositories and traditional payment rails, it's going to take some time. And to be able to remove the friction and increase the confidence that the tools are available, I think is a really important catalyst for that exploration. I know it may take some time. I think we're going to see, I'll call it an uneven distribution and probably a bit of a regression back to a mean for some of the players who may not have the capital or the talent to be able to drive this. But frameworks and tools that can become standards, I think, are really important for bringing that evolution forward. So really, really interesting to hear that. I know we're going to be shorter on time in a moment or two, but Sergey, I just wanted to ask you, based on where you have been and where you are now and how you're looking at the future, what do you think might be the role of the Oracle? Do we even talk about Oracles, or is it just about APIs, connections? You're not even talking about it, it's just the data, and we know that data has been verified.
I think that the important thing about Oracles and Oracle networks is that they can verify things in a provable way that shows that the reliability of that system creates certain key guarantees. And then the counterparties in the transaction will evaluate both the chain and the initial minting of an asset, but then they'll also evaluate the secondary minting system, they'll evaluate the cross-chain system, they'll evaluate the data system that controls the value of the token, they'll evaluate what's checking the reserves, making sure the token is actually backed by real assets. I already see many institutions and even DeFi risk teams evaluating not just a piece of the contract code or the contract code on one chain, but they're evaluating the contract as a multi-chain, externally connected, Oracle-driven system. Mm-hmm. So really what I would say is that I would just shift people's understanding and definition of a smart contract from being a single piece of code on a single chain to being many pieces of code on many chains, as well as the associated Oracle networks that successfully drive and essentially secure those pieces of on-chain code. And so this is really what the future is and what it is now, actually. And this is what we were explaining to folks years ago when we were describing the evolution of Chainlink into a platform that not only does multiple Oracles, but allows Oracles to be a service-oriented architecture-driven system. And the service-oriented architecture-driven system has now essentially been reached by Chainlink. So we've achieved the goal of generating multiple Oracle services, allowing them to interact with multiple contracts on multiple chains, allowing the contracts to interact with each other as services across chains. And that has opened up kind of our eyes to this next problem, which is the orchestration of all that and the management of all that. Like, how do you define your financial applications relationship to the different finality and risk of 100 different chains? How do you define its relationship with your five regulator-required data sources? How do you define its relationship to identity and compliance and various policies? This is really, in addition to having the services, you have to have the services. And the services have to be reliable. But you also now have to have a way to manage the services in an efficient way. And actually, the CRE also runs on a set of Oracle networks. And so the CRE workflow code can also be run in this highly reliable way. And eventually, where you get to in the final end state is you get to a Chainlink runtime environment orchestration set of networks or network that is managing and directing and essentially acting as what's called the control plane of all the services. And the services are the contracts and the Oracle networks and actually the off-chain systems that have their relationship with the contracts defined through the Oracle networks. And that's the end architecture of all this. So that's the final architecture. And we've shown this architecture to some of the smartest people in the DeFi community, some of the smartest people in the institutional community. And everybody's like, yep, that's it. That's what it is. That's how it's going to work. And so that's what the Chainlink community makes now.
Well, that's excellent. Thank you very much for that vision. I can tell you in a past life, running middle and back office operations, looking at the way you have to manage data and orchestration is critical because that eliminates a lot of the unnecessary friction that exists around data state and inaccuracies or inconsistencies in timing, et cetera. So really, really interesting future to look forward to. I think we are, as an industry, and I say this as TradFi and DeFi focused, we are at a convergence point where I think the acceleration comes with increased trust, better tools, better understanding. And I certainly appreciate that standards are a major way that will accelerate further. I think talent too. And the point that you mentioned around service-oriented architecture really landed with me, because another way to say that is that the technology builders understand the jobs to be done of those business people, those compliance people, the traders. And that matters because for them, not being technologists, they want to have trust and faith that they can get their job done with risk that's managed and costs that are managed and, quite frankly, do it faster and cheaper. So it's a really interesting time to be in this industry, and really look forward to seeing what comes out in the future. And I, on behalf of the FCAT Crypto Brief, really want to thank you for spending some time with us and helping us learn more about Chainlink, the Chainlink runtime environment, and honestly, just the way you view the industry. So really appreciate you sharing your knowledge and your time. Thank you.
It was my pleasure. Always great to chat with you. Big fan of Fidelity and all the associated groups there. Excited to see what Fidelity does in the future. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. Thank you. All right, folks, stay tuned for the next episode.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2025 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.